Welcome to the Hillsdale College Online Courses Podcast. I'm Kyle.
And I'm Juan, and we're back with our course on the book of Genesis, the Genesis story. And we're on to lecture number 4 today on Abraham and Isaac. And if you hear those two names, you already know what's coming.
Yes.
Which is one of the most difficult passages to interpret in Scripture, which is the binding or the sacrifice of Isaac. And it is difficult to understand because it seems so contrary to us that God would require or would even ask or suggest something like that to Abraham, especially right after having made a promise to Abraham and fulfilling that promise that Abraham would have a child. So it's one of those things that everybody has heard that story, everybody has puzzled about it, and Dr. Jackson is going to try to walk us through it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think a common reaction to this story is outrage, right? How could God make such a horrific command, and why would Abraham just go along with it, right, in that way? How does that all work? How do we think about it? And that's one of the things I love about Dr. Jackson and this course is, in this case, he points to a common modern interpretation that we hold today as Christians, generally writ large, but also shows some earlier traditions in the Christian faith and in the Jewish faith that have a very different understanding of the meaning of this story of Abraham and Isaac. And I think that's really been helpful for me to unlock a deeper understanding of what's going on here.
And if you're enjoying this course with Dr. Jackson, I encourage you to go to hillsdale.edu/course. We have two other courses with Dr. Jackson, a course on Exodus, the Exodus story, and the David story, which is a course that covers the books of 1 and 2 Samuel and the story of King David, one of Israel's greatest kings. Again, you can go take those courses right now at hillsdale.edu/course. That's hillsdale.edu/course. And now, without further ado, let's turn to Dr. Jackson in Lecture 4 of the Genesis story.
Today we'll be looking at Genesis chapter 22, known as the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, the 10th trial of Abraham. Last time we went through Abraham's 8th and 9th trials, that is the expulsion of Hagar, and the setting off of his son Ishmael. And today we will look at his interaction with his second son, his beloved son, Isaac. And it happened after these things that God tested Abraham. And he said to him, Abraham, and he said, Here I am. And he said, Take, pray, your son, your only one whom you love, Isaac, and go forth to the land of Moriah and offer him up as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I shall say to you. Now, I just want to take some time here and give a little bit of background to the story, because it is probably the most commented on passage in all of the Hebrew Bible, most certainly in the book of Genesis. It may be helpful for us to get a sense of maybe our own understandings of the text. In some ways, a lot of us come to this with a Kierkegaardian-like. He's a Danish philosopher, and he's kind of infected the way in which we read this text. And his reading goes something like this. Abraham is given this not just troubling, but horrific commandment to slaughter his son, to offer his son as a sacrifice to God. And this violates various commandments of God. How will he be given generations that will number the stars in the sky if he murders his son? Let alone even the idea that he will be asked to sacrifice his son. As in other words, he risks being a child murderer. The emphasis in this sort of reading is that there's a sort of obedience, perhaps even a blind obedience on the part of Abraham. He's given a commandment, and nothing will stop him from offering up his son in this moment, this is the very time in which he will be this unique believer. He's known as the knight of great faith, according to this reading. And he's this knight of great faith because it is only his own command which violates all these ethical responsibilities. You have commandments contradicting one another. He finds himself in no man's land and must make this leap. I think in some ways this is a pretty familiar reading to us. We oftentimes think of Abraham's great faith, that he will follow this one command of God, no matter how horrific it may seem, and many of us wince when we hear this command. The second reading is a straightforward Christian reading of the text, coming from Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17. And this one is different from the Kierkegaardian-like reading. Hebrews 11:17 says, "And it was Abraham's great faith who offered up his son, knowing full well that God would restore him to life, as God did in parabole," that is to say, figuratively speaking. So what this reading understands is that Abraham would have gone up and offered his son as a sacrifice, but he would do such a thing not as if it would end God's promise to him that he would have generations following the line of Isaac, because God would restore Isaac from the dead. And we can certainly see all of the Christological implications there. What I want to follow today, and I'm not going to follow it strictly, but a reading I would like to follow today is by a medieval rabbinic reader. His name is Rashi. So as we go through this text, I'm borrowing heavily from some of his keen insights on the literal words of the text. The first thing I want us to pay attention to is Abraham's word. When God says, "Abraham," he says, "Here I am." And the Hebrew for that is hineni. Hineni is this kind of ethical call to say, "I am present before you, God." Or if one is responding to a man, "I am here, I am present before you." So it's almost this call to existence itself. My full being is here in your presence. And he said, "Take, pray your son, your only one whom you love, Isaac." I just want to stop there because it sure seems repetitive. And there's a wonderful midrash here. Midrash is this Jewish form of exegesis that tells stories to get at the heart of the matter here. So when God says, "Take, pray your son," Abraham says, "Oh, but God, I have two sons." And he says, "Your only one." He says, "Oh, but God, each one is the only son to his mother." And remember, all of this is in the background that he loved Ishmael very much. And he says, "The one whom you love," and Abraham says, but God, I love them both." And then finally, God clarifies and says, "Isaac." And now go forth to the land of Moriah, and here's where the language becomes really important. "And offer him up as a burnt offering." And the verb here, "and offer him up," the Hebrew there is Allah. Now, the one first thing that Rashi makes us understand is that the commandment here is not to slaughter. God does not say, "Slaughter your son." He says, "Offer him up." Slaughter, the verb there is sakahat. So to offer him up, Allah. Now, this word, it has a whole range of meaning in the sacrificial order. It can mean simply bring him up. It means to prepare him as an offering, but it can also mean to offer him fully as a whole burnt offering. So everything from the preparation of the offering to offering him as a whole burnt offering. You see now that there's some ambiguity in this phrasing here. If it has the whole spectrum of what it means to offer him up, is it simply to prepare? Is it to prepare and then to offer him up? This is what Abraham is going to be confronted with. And it's inside of this ambiguity that we see that Abraham, in his interaction with Isaac, it's these beautiful moments of faith and perhaps even terror. "And Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took his two lads with him and Isaac his son." Notice there, Isaac his son, in case you've forgotten. And we know now in biblical literature, these repetitions are moments of emphasis, right? They want you to feel this connection between Abraham and his son Isaac. And remember, just in the previous chapter, he had to send his other beloved son Ishmael off as well. "And he split wood for the offering and rose and went to the place that God had said to him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from afar. And Abraham said to his lads, 'Sit you here with the donkey and let me and the lad walk ahead and let us worship and return to you.'" I'm going to stop in this phrasing. It's very interesting. If we give the Kierkegaardian reading, and Abraham thinks he is to go up and offer his son on this altar and perhaps walk back down the mountain as a child murderer, then is he lying to them? If he's really supposed to offer up his son to God, is this whole burnt offering and God takes it from him? Is he lying to the lads here? We can certainly see within the Christian reading that in fact would not be the case, because it would be predicated upon that God would give Isaac back to him to fulfill the promise. Rashi's reading, we see it's not a problem, because is he to prepare him as a burnt offering, all the way up to offering him as a burnt offering, but to prepare him as a burnt offering, in this gesture. It need not be a lie. And Abraham took the wood for the offering and put it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the cleaver, and the fire there would be done in torches to take up the mountain to make sure they have something for the offering. And the cleaver, and the two of them went together. And Isaac said to Abraham his father, "Father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." Hineni, once again, the second time, the first time to God, this language of pure presence. Hineni, my son. I'm here, my son. As he's ready to take him up this mountain and to prepare him, or even to offer him as this offering to God. And Isaac said, "Here is the fire and the wood, but where is the sheep for the offering?" There's a question. And if you're a careful reader, you'll notice that Isaac left something out. Isaac may know that there's something going on here. He asks, "Here is the fire and the wood, but where is the sheep?" But what does he leave off the list? Here is the fire and the wood, but he does not mention the knife. He does not mention the cleaver. And he wants to know, where's the sheep for the offering if we're going up to make an offering? And Abraham said, "God will see to the sheep for the offering, my son." And now the same question is going to raise its head. Is this some sort of maniacal lie on the part of Abraham? Is he looking as Isaac, knowing that Isaac will be that sheep for the slaughter? Is that what he's saying? Or is there still this idea that we are going up to prepare you as an offering without any sense of the slaughter, the sacrifice of you, although that may be a possibility, and we have to hold out for that? Can he say this in earnest to his son, especially as he says, "Hineni, my son"? Is this some sort of trickery? Is this something of holding something back from Abraham? Some of the commentary, they start to see that Isaac knows precisely what's going on here, and there's some sort of a close bonding between the two as they're going up and preparing Isaac for this offering. There's something willful on the part of Isaac in his knowledge of these things. And I love this statement. "And the two of them went together." It's such a simple thing, but it's so beautiful. The two of them went together, right? In this gesture of faith to this God who has asked them something ambiguous, something as simple as preparing him for an offering, and something as terrifying as offering him up as this full burnt offering. And they came to the place that God had said to him. And Abraham built there an altar and laid out the wood and bound Isaac his son and placed him on the altar on top of the wood. Notice here, if we understand Allah as bring him up and prepare him as an offering, then what we see here is it's over. We could leave it at that, but what do we not have? We do not have a sheep. Where are we supposed to go with this? And Abraham reached out his hand and took the cleaver, and here it comes, to slaughter his son. And this is the word that Rashi picks up on, to slaughter his son. And it's at this moment that we have to be taken aback. Rashi reminds us the command was not to slaughter his son, but simply to offer him up as an offering. And it's at the moment when he says he goes to slaughter his son that the Lord's messenger called out to him from the heavens and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am, Hineni, here I am in this presence of you, Lord." Right? Here I am doing precisely what I thought it was that you were asking of me. And he said, "Do not reach out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God and you have not held back your son, your only one, from me." So notice what God rejects here. He rejects the slaughter. He rejects the sacrifice. He sees this offering as an offering of thanks, as an offering to that promise. In some ways, you have one patriarch, Abraham, dedicating our second patriarch, Isaac, into the service of God here at this moment.
Whether you've just started teaching or spent decades in the classroom, you know there's always more to learn. But where do you start? Well, here at Hillsdale College, we have the answer for you. Tried and true. A primer on sound pedagogy by Hillsdale College professor Daniel Copeland. In this little book, you'll read lessons from more than 25 years of Dr. Copeland's classroom experience. It's all distilled into 14 easy-to-read chapters on lesson planning, assignments, and classroom management. and it will help you improve your skills and inspire you as a teacher, one of our most important professions. Whether you've been in front of the classroom for years, or this is your first year, when you read Tried and True, you'll find something to help you keep improving every single day. You don't need to go at it alone. Let Dr. Copeland's real-world experience encourage you and inspire you. You can get your copy today at hillsdale.edu/true. That's hillsdale.edu/true. Thanks for listening.
And Abraham raised his eyes and saw, and look, a ram was caught in the thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up, here it is, as a burnt offering instead of his son. He receives his son back and puts a lamb, the ram in its place as a thanksgiving. And here I'm hoping we can recall the Hagar story in Ishmael, because these scenes are identical. Notice just about the time there is going to be the death of the son, as Abraham lifts the knife above Isaac, it is then that the Lord's messenger calls out to him and stops this. It's the same as when Hagar threw her son to the side and left him for death, even though there was the promise there. We note here it's the same thing. It's going to stop the death of Isaac. And we'll see another parallel here. Abraham raised his eyes. We then wonder, you know, is the ram now miraculously put there? Huh. No, he now just notices this after the word of the messenger has come and has clarified the entire situation. In fact, there's a wonderful midrash that says it is the accuser, that Satan, who is put up the obstacle for the ram so that Abraham would follow through with this slaughter, really having this horrifying moment of the temptation, perhaps gone horribly wrong. He's the one who blocks the ram. But now Abraham lifts his eyes, now that he understands that in fact his son is to live and there is to be generations after his son. And now Abraham called the name of that place Yahweh Yireh, that is to say, on the mount of the Lord, there is sight. It's beautiful. On the mount of the Lord at this moment, there's a sort of clarity to understanding what God's promises are to them. Now, the second question I think we want to ask of this, the first being, where is the ram come from? Right? Where is this? And we realize he just wasn't looking for it. The second question, and not too many people have ever asked this question, I think because we've been so influenced in the West by our stunning paintings of this moment by Caravaggio and Rembrandt. But the question that has to be asked is, how old was Isaac when this was going on? How old was he? He's called a lad. But in Hebrew, the word lad is used, my goodness, from those who are 12 years old all the way up to 30 years old. And even beyond that, Absalom in his prime is called a lad. Most exegetes will put him, the tradition actually says, we're so used to seeing him as a child, 10 years old, 12 years old, right? 10 years old, 12 years old. In the paintings, that we're a little shocked when we think of him as being 20. What if I were to tell you that the traditional understanding is it's 36 or 37 years old, because we're told in the very next chapter, chapter 23, and Sarah's life was 127 years, precisely after this event. That would make Isaac 36, 37. And so then now you have to think, my goodness, this changes things. I mean, let's face it, if Abraham is 114 and Isaac's 14, let's face it, that's still very difficult to put a child on an altar and bind him and offer him up as an offering. But imagine a 20-year-old man, a 36, 37-year-old man, he has to submit to the will of his father. So this isn't only a test of Abraham here. In some ways, it's a test of Isaac. Does he trust in his father? Does he trust in his God? Is he going to be obedient to his father? Does he understand that he is going forth in precisely the path that his father is kind of paving for him here? And I want you to think about that. If this is a passivity, this is a very active passivity. This is a willful passivity. In some ways, we say it's Abraham offering Isaac to God. But in some ways, we also have to understand that it would be Isaac himself offering himself to his father and simultaneously offering himself to God. And I want us to keep in mind this vision of Isaac as this passive character, because it turns out when we see Isaac later in the text, and as we will go through the Jacob and Esau story, he is a very passive character. He is always acted upon. In fact, there's a beautiful moment when it's time to find Isaac a wife. Here in chapter 24, it's time to find Isaac a wife. And so Abraham goes and he sends his messenger to go and find a bride for his son. Chapter 24, verse 13. The messenger says, "Here I am poised by the spring of water, and the daughters of men in the town are coming out to draw water. Let it be that the young woman to whom I say, 'Pray, tip down your jug that I may drink,' if she says, 'Drink, and your camels too,' I shall water. She it is whom you, God, have marked for your servant, for Isaac, and by this I shall know that you have done kindness with my master." He had barely finished speaking when, look, Rebekah was coming out, who was born of Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, with her jug on her shoulder. And the young woman was very comely to look at, a virgin, no man had known her. And she came down to the spring and filled her jug and came back up. And the servant ran toward her and said, "Pray, let me sip a bit of water from your jug." And she said, "Drink, my lord." And she hurried and lowered her jug onto her hand and let him drink. And she said, "Let him drink his fill," and said, "For your camels too." And this is just this brilliant moment of the literary quality here is stunning, because there's an act of reticence. Remember what he said previously. Let it be if she says, "Pray, tip your jug that I may drink." And she says, "Drink and your camels too." Notice the way that she holds back, "and your camels too." She fulfills half of it, stops, and then says, "and your camels too." It's just this beautiful little poetic touch here. "For your camels too, I shall draw water until they drink their fill." And she hurried and emptied her jug into the trough, and she ran again to the well to draw water and drew water for all his camels. And the man was staring at her, keeping silent, to know whether the Lord had granted success to his journey. And this is really just this beautiful moment. What you have here in literary studies is known as a type scene. And the type scene here is a betrothal. Oftentimes in biblical literature, what you will see is that at the betrothal, it will start to map out what this relationship is going to look like. The betrothal scene between the husband and wife maps out for us to give us some understanding of the husband or the wife or both. So for example, you'll see Moses as he finds Zipporah. He's a shepherd, and he chases away the other shepherds who are harassing Zipporah, and Moses will become this great shepherd of the flock. We'll see the betrothal scene with Jacob, who moves this massive rock, and that kind of is indicative that Jacob will do anything for his wife Rachel, serve 20 years for her. So there's something intense in what Jacob does. He's one who strives and always keeps pushing. Right? So it's indicative. In fact, in the Christian tradition, in John chapter 4, you have Jesus meeting the Samaritan woman, Fotini, by the well. And what are they speaking of? Of her husbands. And there, this can be taken that she is now going to become part of this mystical bride of Christ as he speaks to her of marriage. She's going to follow him at that point. So then with all of that as kind of that background, look at what we have here. We have a character who's so very passive, he can't even make it to his own betrothal scene, combined with a woman who is doing this Herculean task of watering camels, which is really stunning. The amount of water that a camel would be able to consume, and Alter makes note of this, to what the camels would be able to consume, and she's going and filling these jugs to water them. It's absolutely stunning. If you're reading this as it's being depicted, she would be a blur, running back and forth filling these waters. So on the one hand, you have this character who's so passive, he can't show up to his betrothal scene, and this character who's so absolutely active, she is unstoppable. Well, this is going to map out for us what we will see in our next episode, the very beginning of the Jacob and Esau story. where Rebekah is on the side of Jacob and Isaac is on the side of Esau. And we see Rebekah informing Jacob of the way in which to manipulate his father so as to get his blessing. And that's what we'll cover next time, the Jacob and Esau story.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hillsdale Online Courses podcast. If you want to continue learning about the book of Genesis or other topics, please visit hillsdale.edu/course. There you can find over 40 free online courses, including American Citizenship and Its Decline with Victor Davis Hanson, C.S. Lewis on Christianity, Ancient Christianity, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Republic, and many more. The courses include additional readings, study guides, fully produced videos, and you can chat with your fellow students on a dedicated forum. Upon completing a course, you will also get a certificate. All our courses are free because we believe that a virtuous citizen is the best defense for liberty. So pursue the education necessary for freedom and happiness at hillsdale.edu/course today. That's hillsdale.edu/course. Thanks for listening.